You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Emmanuel Probst.
What is a brand? And a brand is a set of emotional attributes we associate to that relationship with a company.
Emmanuel's background combines over 15 years of market research and marketing experience with strong academic achievements. At Ipsos, Emmanuel supports numerous Fortune 500 companies by providing them with a full understanding of their customers' journey. This encompasses brand awareness to purchase and recommendation, leading to greater insights on the consumer within it. His clients span across a wide range of industries, including consumer packaged goods, retail, financial services, advertising agencies, and media outlets. Emmanuel also teaches consumer market research at the University of California at Los Angeles and writes about consumer psychology for numerous publications. Emmanuel holds an MBA in marketing from the University of Hull, United Kingdom, and a doctorate in consumer psychology from the University of Nottingham Trent, United Kingdom. Emmanuel, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you, Nick. It's great talking with you today. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, and what I'm fascinated with what you work on, what you teach, is that it's all very, very centered around the consumer, from your teaching to what you write about and work with a clients across sectors on. This is a very interesting time, I would think, to be in the business of understanding consumers.
It is indeed. It's so much fun. And especially as we see smaller brands entering the market with very, very disruptive strategies. I have in mind specifically the direct-to-consumer brands. So studying consumers is a fulfilling project because it never ends. There is always something new to learn, particularly in this day and age with, again, our big brands, Nike, Coke, and the likes, Gillette, but also much smaller brands entering the market and disrupting the traditional relationship between consumers and brands.
So what is there anything that, from the consumer perspective, that those disruptors have in common that they're bringing to the table at this very unique time?
Yeah, thank you. I think what disruptors bring to the table is a personal relationship with clients. So for the longest time, personalization and a personal relationship between the brand and the customer was the exclusivity of luxury. If you look 10, 15 years ago, the only ones that could excel at personalizing an experience for you were literally the likes of Ritz-Carlton and Rolls-Royce, not even BMW and Mercedes. Today, thanks to all the information we collect and make sense of, what we like to call big data, the smaller brands can deliver a personal experience and reflect not only on what you have been buying from them lately, but also what is your mindset and what life stage are you in and what you aspire to do, and of course some demographics information and also information about what you've looked at on their website and so on and so forth. And the bottom line is this makes for a much more personal, direct experience between the brand and the consumer.
Well, I love what you said about kind of those tried and true examples that we always point to as examples of exceptional service, of Ritz-Carlton, of Rolls-Royce. And those are great examples, but they never felt as approachable just because of their sheer size and history. Someone reading about those brands would think, I can't do that. I'm not Ritz-Carlton. But these disruptors, armed with a level of information that we haven't had before, are now able to, I guess I would almost say, compete at that same level.
Well, you're right. Those brands were big. Those brands have a lot of history. And also, they have margins, frankly, that contrast sharply with margins you see in the CPG world, for example. In other words, it's easy for Ritz-Carlton to say, well, we will do everything for you and anything for you. When you sell a hotel room at $700 a night, it's much harder to translate this experience at a Marriott Courtyard that sells at $129. So again, that's the power of data and of changing this relationship between the brand and the consumer, is to leverage data to make the experience more personal and enabling smaller brands to enter the market, brands that don't have the clout and the history of Ritz-Carlton and Rolls-Royce, for example.
Well, that's really interesting, the example specifically that you brought up in there with, you know, staying in the hotel space with Ritz-Carlton, because I think it's easy to think of disruptors, to think of the Ubers, the Airbnb that are changing entire markets, but bringing up a brand, a mid-market brand, like Courtyard by Marriott, and talking about what you might be able to do there, I think is a fascinating look at the opportunity provided by data.
Agreed. I'm amazed to see these smaller brands, meaning we spoke about Courtyard, which is part of Marriott. That's a very big operator. But right. I'm amazed to see some brands in the DTC space establishing those very personal relationships, very meaningful relationship with consumers, even though they don't have the history, even though they don't have dozens of millions of dollars to spend on advertising. And they compete in markets that are theoretically saturated because the big guys have been owning these markets for dozens and dozens of years.
Well, and that's an important thing to point out, too. That's why I thought, you know, I mentioned the size and history. But you, by adding that margin in there, that really kind of drives that home as well. When you talk about relationship and that's the real opportunity that data provides, I think that almost leads to a natural segue into what brand means today, because I think there's so many that want to say that branding is this stuffy old thing and that it's not something that we focus on at the same level, but I think that really couldn't be farther from the truth. And I think that this point of the linkage of data relationships naturally leads you to brand. Is that true for today's customer?
I think that's a great question. Interestingly, I've been thinking through this weekend, what is a brand? And a brand is a set of emotional attributes we associate to that relationship with a company. And what I mean by this, very often my students tell me, well, us millennials, we don't like brands. Or Gen Z, well, we don't like brands. Yeah, you don't like brands. You just order from Amazon all day long. You just listen to music on Spotify all day long. Oh, and by the way, where did you grab dinner before coming to class? Oh, you went to Chipotle. Well, that's interesting. So often when people say they don't like brands, which I respect, by the way, is we have in mind the traditional big powerhouses type of brands, the H&M, the Zara, maybe the Nike, the Adidas. These are brands, if you will, legacy brands, traditional brands in the traditional sense of what a brand is. But I'd argue that private labels, for example, or a white t-shirt, these are brands also. They just have a different set of emotional attributes and it's a slightly different path to purchase. It's definitely a different relationship between the brand and the consumer. But there are brands that are just as strong. If you look at Target's private labels brands, that brand is just as strong as Clorox, as an example. It's just a different relationship, and it's a different context for this relationship between the company, the producer, and the consumer.
Are you enjoying this conversation about branding? If so, I'd love to bring my Brand Now keynote speech to your next conference or corporate event. Based on my popular book, Brand Now, this talk breaks down the seven dynamics of building a standout brand in our crowded, distracted world. Entertaining and educational, your audience will learn, laugh, and leave with ideas they can implement right away. Learn more, including watching video and viewing popular presentation topics at nickwestergaard.com/speaking. That's nickwestergaard.com/speaking. Now back to the show.
Well, I think it is. It is a different relationship. And it makes me think that story that you told about students, and I'm also a teacher at the University of Iowa, and that sounds familiar, and it's almost makes me think of cognitive dissonance, because this kind of space between, you know, I don't like brands, and yet we see that these consumers are attracted to things that I think you'd probably have to call brands, but that's not the way they think of it. So it does get back to consumer behavior in an interesting way, because it is something that is very much brand-driven, but not in a way that seems to proactively identify that as being tied to a brand. So I guess my question is, as brand builders, do we need to approach this work differently, knowing that brands are important, but they're not thought of as important by the consumers?
I think we need to build slightly different brands, if you will. Again, we still want to associate emotions to this experience between the consumer and the company, the producer, if you will. In terms of the output, we want to be less conspicuous. In fact, to speak 3D, I will say we want to be less flashy. We want to emphasize other aspects of the experience. Is the brand sustainable? Is the brand good to the environment? Does the brand have a purpose? Is the brand meaningful and fulfilling for consumers? Is the brand, does the brand want to establish a long-term relationship with the consumers? And all these are as important, more important these days than flashy advertising, if you will. So if we want to build brands that are sustainable and that will be meaningful in the long run, that's what we need to do. Not just advertise on price and advertise on my brand is better than competitor A, B, and C.
That's a really great point. Less flashy. This makes me think of, and kind of coming full circle to some of the iconic brands that you talked about. Last week I was speaking at Marketing Profs B2B Forum, and Kara Swisher was there and was talking about the role of marketing today in a tech world that has some questionable ethics. And she brought it back to a Steve Jobs quote where it talked about marketing being quiet. And that makes me think of what you just said about not being flashy. And I think that that's another one of those things that rings true, but doesn't immediately feel true, because a lot of times I feel like our instinct as marketers is to kind of loudly bang together all the pots and pans and make all sorts of noise. And I'm not sure that's the best approach. And it sounds like it's definitely not the best approach with today's consumer.
Yeah, that's an interesting quote. I've not heard that before from Steve Jobs on the need for marketing to be quiet. And on a personal level, I've never met Steve Jobs, so I cannot talk to any relationship with the individual. On a professional level, I always had a love-hate relationship with Steve Jobs, and part of me, I admire what he built, and importantly, his vision, his ability to create products. What I mean by vision, that's an important word, his ability to create products that people didn't know they will need or didn't know they will want. So that's genius. On the other side, sometimes when we hear, for example, that he didn't like market research, well, that's not true. Apple does tons of market research, especially qualitative research. Or when we hear about the need for marketing to be quiet, no offense, but looking at the show Apple puts on in Cupertino each time they release a product, and looking at the massive advertising campaigns they have going on right now for the new iPhone 13 as an example, among many of their other products, and also a very, very conspicuous retail strategy, I wouldn't call that quiet. That's not, in my opinion, it is more subtle. I would describe it as subtle and classy, if you will, certainly not quiet.
Well, it's interesting because it's kind of got me thinking, because we always point to, and I feel like if you stop people on the street right now and ask them who's a great brand that comes to mind, they'd say Apple. But I think it's interesting when you talk about today's consumer and certainly seeing Apple have some dust ups with that in the area of privacy, of different things, all of the points that you just made, some of the things that are a little opaque and autocratic in nature. It makes me wonder if a brand like Apple appeared today, would they still become the Apple that we know and love?
That's a great question again. Well, Apple came up with some... Apple did not invent the iPhone nor the iPod. Apple managed to make a functional product emotional in nature. In other words, Apple never sold on features and benefits, but really Apple sells products based on emotions. So will they succeed today? It certainly wouldn't be as easy. Right. In fact, one could argue that Apple has not released any disruptive products for a while now. The iPad was disruptive, the iPod was disruptive, and in a way, the iPhone was disruptive. There's nothing very disruptive coming out of the Apple brain these days, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because at the risk of sounding like we're piling on Apple, I'm sitting here recording this via a MacBook Air and with my iPhone sitting right over there. So I'm very comfortably in the ecosystem and not going anywhere. But to that point about not releasing a disruptive product doing some of the in years, it's almost like they have situated themselves in the business of being Apple, which is kind of something maybe a little bit different than some of that history as well.
And here again, it's a brand that has a very, very strong emotional component, a very strong bond with its customers, with its users. To your point, they're a little bit in the business of being Apple. And that's, I think, actually a great example of a brand that it's trendy to say, well, people don't like brands, and millennials and Gen Z, they like to reject brands. Although at the end of the day, Apple's got a very large market share in the tablet and in the smartphone market. So again, it's not about the price because the device is more expensive. It's not about features and benefits because the features and benefits are comparable to competitors, if not lower. It's really about this emotional attachment to the brand. And you asked me earlier, Nick, do we need to work differently? And how do people relate to brands these days? Well, I think marketers have done such a great job over the last 30, 40 years that consumers use brands every day and are attached to brands and they don't even realize it. So that was my point when we said, well, people reject brands. They reject brands. The only thing is they order from Amazon, listen from Spotify, and eat at McDonald's and Chipotle. The point is, and Apple in a way is the same thing. Yeah, students, they tell me they reject brands. They just used MacBooks and iPads and iPhones and sometimes all three devices within the same hour, if you will. So the point being that a brand like Apple did such a good job at emphasizing the emotional benefit that this brand is now ingrained in people's life. And in a way, they might not even realize that it's a brand anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting because it is, I think it's the good parallel of that people point out with a brand, a well-built brand, that it becomes, I mean, it's emotional capital, but it's not unlike monetary capital too, that I think that a brand like Apple is continuing to draw on that as well, on some of those early investments that they made and those connections to people that they still enjoy.
Which, and that's where I'm giving a lot of credit to Apple, which shows the importance to invest in the brand. And this reminds us that building a brand is a long-term endeavor. And of course, programmatic advertising in the lower funnel, it creates the illusion that you can sell products over the weekend and you can experience instant return on investment on your marketing. Well, that's technically not true. Yes, you can drive traffic this weekend, but if you want to build a relationship in the long run, you need to invest in the brand. And that's what Apple did so well. And I also want to credit them for deploying a very strong, very ambitious retail strategy at a time a few years ago when everyone saw the malls dying. So in that way, that's where the genius is, in investing in the brand and in doing something that is very, very counterintuitive, investing in stores when everyone's closing stores. So it paid off, and it pays off in the long run to invest in the brand, and Apple is the best example of that.
That is a great example that I think of, and that long-term investment. It makes me think, at the event last week, I was moderating a roundtable on branding, and you know, we were having a lot of very good discussions, and someone said, okay, but how do you measure all of this? And the tone sounded a bit like, yes, but I want something for tomorrow's dashboard. And if I hear you correctly, it sounds like I don't know that tomorrow's dashboard can show brand movement, or can it?
Yeah, well, programmatic advertising, digital advertising in general, creates the illusion that all metrics are instantly available. Here's what I mean. It is so tempting to look at click-through rates and conversion rates and website traffic and bounce rates and number of page views and all this. It's tempting for several reasons. One, it feels instantaneous. It feels like if you spend $10,000, $1 million, or $10 million last week on advertising, you can monitor your return on ad spend straight away. And it's also tempting because those metrics are so easy to understand. You need zero background, very, very, very little training in market research and in marketing analytics to understand what a click-through rate and a bounce rate is about. For these reasons, people love with metrics, and they feed the dashboard for tomorrow morning, to use your expression. Conversely, the upper funnel metrics around brand awareness and sentiment and all that, they're not as instantaneous because, as you said, Nick, those metrics, you know, sure, they'll make it to tomorrow morning's dashboard, but they're not really the gist of it. And frankly, they require a little bit more digging, a little bit more knowledge in what makes a brand, in market research and brand sentiment and affinity and attitudes and all those metrics. So net-net, both are very important, I think, for marketers. You can indeed use those lower funnel metrics to guide your tactics to decide how and where you're going to invest in advertising next week. That's all good. And to be candid, you can use those metrics to show some immediate success to your boss, and you should. At the same time, do not lose sight of the upper funnel metrics of the brand health, again, sentiments, attitudes, the emotional measurement of that relationship between your company and the brand, or else you won't have anything to show for in 9, 12, 15, 18 months.
Well, speaking of the emotional measurement to a brand, the time has come in the podcast for me to ask a brand that has made you smile recently.
Two brands come to mind, and the first one is a brand called The Farmer's Dog. And it is one of those direct-to-consumer DTC brands. And The Farmer's Dog sells meal plans to pet owners. And they just deployed that very, very fun ad campaign. It's mostly an outdoor campaign. But the theme is basically dogs want to eat some real food, if you will. So what's funny is, of course, they chose some funny dogs, if you will, to illustrate the ads. And arguably, that's easy to do in the pets market, right? I mean, to find some cute cats and some cute dogs. But the messaging, and I don't have one particular billboard that comes to mind, but the messaging is good fun as well. Basically, the theme is around, well, your dog doesn't want to eat dog food. Your dog needs and wants to eat real food. So I think that's a great example of, first, a small firm taking on the big guys. The Farmer's Dog is probably 60, 70 employees, taking on the likes of Nestle, Purina. And two, it's a good example of the power of advertising, because we're all exposed to thousands of ads every day. And interestingly, that's the one I recall. So I think they're doing amazingly well.
That is a great example. I've not heard of The Farmer's Dog, but I, as someone with a dog who is peacefully slumbering just feet away from me as I'm making this recording, it did stop and make me think as well.
Well, you know, I actually just Googled it, Nick, to remind myself of their billboards. And one, for example, is real food made fresh, tested on humans. So
I like that spin.
Yeah. So it's such a great way to convey a message. And, you know, most people think that advertising is garbage, and rightly so, because once again, too much advertising is in your face, useless interruption. You're trying to sell me more of something I don't need. From time to time, you see campaigns that bring back the beauty and the art of advertising, and that's one. And it makes me smile as a consumer, but also it feels very fulfilling as a marketing professional. It shows that advertising serves a purpose and can be artful.
Awesome. Well, that's a great one. I'm glad to expose it to more folks and to check it out myself. Where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Oh, thank you, Nick. My LinkedIn profile is very detailed, and I'm simply at Emmanuel Probst. Emmanuel is spelled with two M's, E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L, and my last name is Probst, P-R-O-B as in boy, S T. So my LinkedIn profile is the place to go because you'll find extensive details, obviously, about my professional and academic background, but I also post a lot, some sound bites and some tips on what to do with your brand, and some articles I write and publish. So that's the best place to find me. I'm also on Instagram to reach a different audience. I have a really large presence on LinkedIn, less so on Instagram, but it's a great platform to reach, again, a different audience and establish a different relationship with the audience. And my Instagram handle is Real French Boy, all in one word.
All right. Well, that one requires no spelling, but regardless, exactly. Regardless of the spelling, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Emmanuel, thanks for being on Brand with us.
Thank you so much, Nick. Really appreciate having me on the show.
And as a reminder, you can find the links to everything Emmanuel and I talked about at onbrandpodcast.com. If you like what you're hearing, remember to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts. They'll still have us, hopefully, after the podcast. Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you like to listen. And please take a moment, rate, review the podcast, help others find the show. For more, including how you can sign up for my In Case You Missed It newsletter, please visit nickwestergaard.com. That's Westergaard with two A's, spelling everything out this week. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.